copy it down, Eagle.
He is a radical anti-establishment thinker.
Cummings' time in government convinced him that the political system was fundamentally broken.
Liftoff! We have a liftoff!
And that nothing short of radical overhaul could transform it into what he called a high-performance institution.
Taking Control, the Dominic Cummings story. A BBC Two documentary revealed that Dominic Cummings can be described as many things to many people. He is reportedly fearless in his views, but what are his views? Antagonistic to bureaucracy? A myth maker? A shaker-upper? Is this an occupation? A Renaissance man? A Svengali type that emulates Rasputin? And apparently a campaign mastermind? But what exactly did we learn about the man and about the ideology that drives him? And thinking about his current role that makes him the most powerful unelected man in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, is he going about his attempts at reforming Whitehall in the right way? Over the years, there have been many attempts to reshape and reform the civil service and the machinery of government. Will Dominic Cummings' attempts bear any fruit? Joining me to discuss the BBC documentary on Mr. Cummings and his attempts to reform Whitehall is Mark Littlewood, Director General at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and Professor Len Shackleton, Editorial and Research Fellow here at the Institute. Mark, first of all, what did you think of the documentary? You obviously had a starring role in it yourself.
Well, I had a bit part role in it, Darren. It's very kind of you say it was a starring role. I mean, I sort of thought it was an okay introduction to Dominic Cummings, the ideology and the man. I think probably if you've followed his career to date or have read newspaper articles about him over the last few years, it probably wouldn't have told you much that you didn't already know. And although I thought as a sort of pen picture, it gave you a reasonable education, that didn't really get to the bottom of what I think is the most interesting question, which is what actually is his ideology. It was sort of an overview of his career and his achievements and some of the scrapes he's got into. But I remain really none the wiser about what actually makes this guy tick and to what extent free market liberals should consider him to be an ally and to what extent he should be considered to be an enemy. And I think it's probably a bit of a mixed picture in truth. And this documentary has not made the picture any less mixed in my mind.
Do you think he does have any philosophy or guiding ideology behind him?
Well, I was reading up a little bit around him, obviously in advance of doing the documentary interview, which was a good few weeks ago and since. And sort of, yes. I mean, you can't as easily sort of pigeonhole him as easily as you could say pigeonhole me. I mean, basically, if you read Robert Nozick's Anarchy, State and Utopia, you know what I believe in. But with Dom, it seems to be a whole range of disparate influences and not necessarily books of political or philosophical or economic ideology, but a sort of a mix of Russian literature and business plans and the ideas of entrepreneurial businessmen and agencies in various areas. So you've got to piece together this slightly odd mosaic about what he believes in. And I don't think there is such a thing as Cummingsism, but neither is it easy to put him in any particular box. So If I were to give it a go, I mean, he is broadly in favour of sort of capitalism and markets and business. You know, he's not, so to that extent, I think he thinks that is the way that the world works. He's not a sort of full-blown socialist or command and central planner, not a full-blown one at any rate. And he is a force for creative destruction. I'm not sure you could go so far as say this is an ideology, but he definitely thinks that the way the state is constructed at the moment in Britain and across the Western world is far from ideal, and large amounts of it need to be effectively blown up. And that probably warms the cockles of those of us who are sceptical about the bureaucratic state as it stands. But he does seem to believe that this can be replaced with some form of brilliant, intelligent design run by him and perhaps a handful of other geniuses from number 10 Downing Street, rather than actually reducing the scale, scope breadth and depth of government altogether. So part of it, you could say, if you wanted to take a dim view of his approach to policy from a classical liberal perspective, is not that he's even rearranging the deck chairs on the deck chairs on the Titanic. He's merely wants to rearrange who sits in those deck chairs. Well, and I don't think that would end in great success.
Yeah, we'll get on to that in a sec. But why do you think then there are lots of examples in that documentary, actually, of praise from classical liberal allies like Daniel Hannan and Douglas Carswell, as well as, I think to a certain extent, yourself? Why do you think he does find allies in the quarters in which the IEA does operate?
Well, I mean, I would say, if you want my own judgment, but the jury's out, he is probably, on balance, a more benign force than you would usually find in that position because of his creative destruction instincts. So I think there is a fair chance that the sort of lazy, ossified bureaucracy in a number of areas will be shaken up, and I welcome that. But when it shakes down rather than being shaken up, I'm not sure I'm going to get the utopia I want, probably just something a little bit better, perhaps a little bit more, a bit leaner, perhaps a little bit more market orientated. I mean, a good test case, I guess, from history would be the Free Schools Project, which sort of he and Gove developed when they were at the Department for Education. And, you know, it isn't my first best option of what free market education should look like. It's still got a lot of bureaucracy attached to it. I don't think it's brought about a complete revolution in the British educational landscape. But all in all, I think it's probably a move for the better. It's probably marginally improved things, marginally liberalised things. And so if we get that in other departments, then classical liberals might not be celebrating morning, noon and night about it, but might note that it's a sort of slight shift or move in generally the right direction.
Do you think his reforming zeal explains why he's so successful as a campaigner then?
No, I think they're actually rather different. I mean, I think he's sort of laser focused on a campaign. I mean, I know that's what campaigners tend to do, you know, find a slogan or a meme or a message and repeat it over and over again until you've bored yourself to death and pretty much bored the electorate into submission. So it's a completely different communication strategy to a think tank, which tends to talk about lots of issues in a discursive fashion. He's very data driven. I think that the history books that are already being written about the 26 referendum campaign suggest an approach to targeting messages in a much more modern way than the old sort of stake post leaflets and knocking door to door traditional campaigning techniques. And he does seem to sort of know the things that make, if you like, the ordinary voter tick and click. So he was able to cut through normal sort of media memes and the way that you would present questions in quite an interesting, direct way. And I know there's a whole controversy about the bus with the $350 million price tag on it and how honest or dishonest that was. But a great success in his campaign was to able to move the debate onto his territory. And I think I mentioned it very fleetingly in the documentary that the point of the bus and the $350 million assertion was not that it was going to be a universally accepted and accurate figure. It was to move the debate onto, all right, how big is the figure then? Mm-hmm. And people just got into their heads that it was a colossal figure. I mean, if the other side wanted to come back and say, well, it's only half that, well, 175 million is still a pretty colossal figure. So it wasn't really to communicate a particular idea, proposition or policy proposal. It was to shift the parameters of debate onto turf that Dom Cummings thought would be useful for the successful outcome of his personal campaign, or not his personal campaign, but the campaign in which he was personally involved. And on that, I think he has been more successful than many other communicators and campaigners in modern Britain.
Len, to bring you in, you've wrote in the past, quite recently actually, that those who have been around the block a few times might recall many attempts to reshape and reform the civil service and indeed the machinery of government. Can you give us any historical examples of similar attempts?
Well, you know, history never repeats itself exactly, but I think of two particular initiatives. The first, Harold Wilson's government in 1964, and the second is Ted Heath's government in 1970. Back in 1964, Wilson, who was a very impressive figure at the time, came into power with the idea that there'd been 13 wasted years of Tory government, and he wanted to change that. And he brought in the idea of the National Plan, which is something we'd never had before. He instituted a new department, the Department of Economic Affairs, as a sort of counterpoint to the Treasury, which had always been seen as a very, very reactionary kind of body. And he brought in some weirdos from outside government, in particular two guys, Nikki Kaldor and Tommy Balogh, who are both Hungarian, both economists and both kind of radical thinkers. So he had a setup here which looked like it was going to shake things up. And indeed, it, you know, for a few months it did so. But unfortunately, within 18 months, the whole lot was dead in the water as a result of the sterling crisis. The second example is the Heath government in 1970. Well, he wanted two things. One was to reform the structure of government, and he set up something called the Central Policy Review Staff, which was got the nickname very quickly of think tank, the first time it really been used, that expression, in the UK under Lord Rothschild, and then a succession of people after Rothschild. And this was to sort of think the unthinkable, if you like, in 1970 terms. And part of what they wanted to do, of course, also was to roll back the state. And they had this big, the Conservatives have this big conference at Selsdon Park, where they talked about cutting public expenditure, liberating markets. There were going to be no lame ducks in the future who were nationalised. They were not going to persist in Wilson's prices and incomes policy. All these wonderful ideas. Then, of course, again, that was dead within 18 months or so. First, because of a massive rise in unemployment, that financial crisis, and a succession of things. And of course, the Heath government ended up being voted out of power over an argument about a miners' strike. Mm-hmm. Now, what both these episodes show, I think, is that you can have some these radical ideas, but you get derailed by events. Things happen. You know, this is Macmillan's famous line about events, dear boy, and so forth. And of course, what we've got at the moment in Britain is one hell of a big event in the coronavirus problem.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether that's going to mean that all these ideas which Dominic Cummings has been knocking around will actually come to very little. It all depends to a considerable degree on Boris Johnson's political credibility, and that could all go pear-shaped. I don't know if these ideas will ever really take off.
Yeah, I mean, Mark, if you put a coronavirus to one side, why do you think these lofty ideas like those proposed by Dominic Cummings ultimately end up failing to reform Whitehall in any meaningful way?
Well, I think Len's put his finger on it, that you can have the best laid plans, which, if you like, aim and probably would only affect things over a relatively long term. You know, you sort of bring in reforms that you hope, I don't know, for sake of argument, might improve the efficiency of the welfare system over a 5-year period, or the literacy and numeracy rates over a 10-year period. And then something comes along which requires, in the minds of politicians, some short-term immediate response. Perhaps it does genuinely require a short-term immediate response. The coronavirus is an obvious example of that. But therefore, politicians, the political establishment, the government of the day, gets itself onto a cycle of, you know, maybe not quite what what's tomorrow's newspaper headline is going to be. And, the aim is simply to survive for another 24 hours, but not far off that time horizon. And therefore, anything that might be a bit painful today or a bit awkward to deal with today and can actually be put in the pending tray for consideration at a different time while we deal with the sterling crisis, the miners' strike, or a pandemic, or whatever it might be, tends to be the way that politicians and operate. That, you know, long-term reform is rarely at the top of the agenda unless you have a prolonged period of peace, prosperity, and stability. And usually something comes along to mix that up. So, we obviously don't know what sort of British politics and the government and the economy is going to look like when we finally emerge from this. This coronavirus pandemic, but clearly Dominic Cummings won't be pushing any of his reforms through now. You know, we're in the hands of people who are experts at dealing with a short-term emergency. So it's that short-termism, even if short-termism is sometimes justified, that I think often derails these sort of reforming projects. And to refer back to the piece that Len wrote for the IEA on the 9th of January this year, which gives you an idea of some of these historical episodes which he's referred to and failures in the past. I mean, it seems to me actually really the medicine that's needed is to narrow the scope of government, to sort of shut down programs and departments and to end particular efforts and simply hand those over to the free side of the economy rather than shuffling them around, because shuffling them around is something that can easily be benched for weeks, months, or indeed indefinitely. And that might be what actually becomes of Dominic Cummings' programme, given the crisis we're presently dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, Len, Dom's Cummings himself cites evidence that mega projects, those over $1 billion, for example, run by all types of government, often fail and fail for reasons that are repeated time and time again, whether that be defence procurement, tackling climate change, lifelong learning. Bad decisions are made, bad projects are contrived, and its bad leadership continues. Lingering harm of the public and any future governments that are now saddled with the debts from those failures and the personnel trained to repeat it over and over again. Nothing changes. You can understand his frustration, but still nothing changes. I mean, you must be wanting to pull your hair out, Len, are you?
well, to be fair, I think you know, the private sector also makes big mistakes from time to time, and things go pear-shaped and so forth. What Dominic Cummings seems to from my point of view, why I worry about his thinking is that he believes that government somehow can overcome the inevitable radical uncertainty of the world. I've just been reading this book by Mervyn King and John Kay, about radical uncertainty. And it's absolutely right. We cannot predict the future. And, Dominic's vision of a new technological British-led revolution or something, if we pump some government money into things, I think it's fantasy. And to go back to what Mark was saying, I think we should be looking for ways in which we can get government to concentrate on the things which inevitably it has to do, like handling a coronavirus event, and get it out of a lot of the areas into which its tentacles have spread over the last 30 or 40 years.
Mark, you did touch on it earlier, but you could argue, couldn't you, Dominic Cummings was successful in taking on the blob and actually succeeding in the Department for Education and bringing about free schools? That's a sign of genuine reform, isn't it?
Things that have good impact should be welcomed, and I think this is one of them. But it's not a revolutionary impact. And if I had to guess, I haven't discussed this with him directly, it's probably been less of an impact than Dominic Cummings, A, would have wanted, and B, actually believed would happen. Because, again, free schools came up against blob-like problems, local education authorities seeking to frustrate the setting up of new free schools, for example, it becoming far more bureaucratic to establish these entities than the initial plan had foreseen or hoped. But I think you can do some modest reforms. I'm perhaps not quite as pessimistic as Len, although I agree with his overarching analysis of the flaw at the heart of the Cummings thinking. But I suppose what I'd like to back to Len is, what sort of reforms in a very second, third or fourth best way in Whitehall do you think that free market, classically liberally orientated people might welcome, even if it wasn't their optimum? I mean, I think you and I are agreed that we could find whole tranches of government intervention, regulation and programmes that we would just snuff out and extinguish. But do you think there's anything that could be done, even if it wouldn't be a kind of IEA sort of approach or plan, that might improve things, whether that's performance-related pay, whether that's incentivising civil servants with to end programmes and giving them a bonus associated with that, whether it is more external influence, bringing in expertise rather than having people who have served for 35 years as a permanent secretary. Is there anything, however minimalist or however modest in its reach or ambitions, that might make the world a better place? Or is it a sort of all or nothing? You either leave it in the hands of the state, which will generally be bad in a good number of ways that the market economy could operate better, or, you know, you hand it over to the market economy. Is there something somewhere in the middle that we might welcome in a modest incremental reform type way?
I think there are certainly ways in which government might be improved, but I think some of the sort of tick box list that you have there have been tried. You know, performance related pay. When I worked in the civil service briefly, we had performance related pay, but it was fairly pointless. People tended to fall in the middle of things, and everybody get roughly the same in the end. It didn't really make much difference. Management expertise, well, you know, there are management fads, delayering and all that kind of stuff, which might be taken on board. But, you know, the private sector has no magic, you know, formula here. Successful firms take many different forms, and there isn't something we could very easily copy. No, I come back to, I think we should be shedding areas of responsibility. We should be closing down some departments, say media, culture and sport has always been high on my list, and see if we can do rather less things, rather better.
Well, a question to both of you then to end. Do you think rolling back egregious expansions of state interference should be the goal? I sort of already know your answer given the rest of the podcast so far. Rather than spending what could well turn out to be far too much time and political capital, indeed, trying to make the government apparatus more efficient at expanding its role still further. I'll start with Len.
Yeah, I think political capital wastes very quickly. You know, election results of a half-life of about 10 minutes when your popularity evaporates. And we could well see this happening before too long. So I think it's important that that the government concentrates on a number of key things rather than trying to reconstruct the whole government universe.
Mark?
I'm rather with that. Len said that the Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport is high up on his death list. I think probably top of mine is the Department for Business, Enterprises, Innovation and Skills, probably the four things that governments are worst at. No point in them being involved at all in business, enterprise, innovation or skills. So, yes, I think that, you know, really market liberals need to be looking at extinguishing things, not reformulating them. I think there is probably some room for incremental change in certain areas. But if you were to look at the free schools program, really that was a market reform. I mean, it wasn't changing who set the curriculum at the Department for Education. It was simply allowing in a certain pseudo market sector. So it might be that you can get those sort of reforms in a good number of areas. But the main challenge is to cut back the weeds, not actually worry too much about who your employed gardener is.
Right. Cheers, both. Thanks for virtually joining me today.
Good to speak to you, Darren.
Don't forget to let us know what you thought about this podcast by rating it on Apple Podcasts. And for more podcasts, films, blogs, and reports, go to our website, iea.org.uk. Thank you for listening.